You're listening to The Write Process, a podcast in which one writer tells the story of completing one work from concept to completion. I'm your host, Charlie Jensen.
Hi, I'm Nancy Pine, and I wrote a book called One in a Billion, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey Through Modern-Day China.
Nancy Pine holds a PhD in education and is a professor emerita at Mount St. Mary's University, Los Angeles, where she directed the Elementary Education Program and the Bridging Cultures U.S.-China Program. She has done cross-cultural research in China and the United States for over 20 years, has published over 30 education and research articles, many related to China or cross-cultural learning, and has given talks and workshops throughout the United States and internationally. Dr. Pine has spent extended periods in rural China, including 5 lengthy visits to one village, to teach teachers from neighboring communities, consult in the local school, and learn about rural life. Her book, One in a Billion, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey Through Modern-Day China, grew from that experience and challenged her to move from academic to narrative writing. One in a Billion is a powerful account of how one stubborn, hardworking Chinese man has lived by his values, stood up for his convictions, and succeeded against all odds in the authoritarian environment of China, despite grinding poverty, hunger, re-education campaigns, and attacks from jealous peers. An Wai has launched one innovative project after another, including a democratic congress in his own village. Resilient to the core, he has continuously worked to overcome corruption, improve the world, and build understanding between China and the West. As tensions rise over human rights in China and potential military threats grow, An Wai's story becomes ever more significant.
I had been going to China for 10 years before I met the man who actually is the central figure in the book. But before that, I had collected some other stories of people I was interested in who had been born at the beginning of the People's Republic of China, who were people who were willing to push back against some of the things they didn't like, which wasn't always a popular thing to do. They also were just articulate people and interesting. And then I met An Wai, and it became obvious to me. He came from a village. It was a whole set of information I didn't know much about. After spending some time in the village on a project, when he was there, I actually realized that it would be a great story for Americans. And so that's how it got started, except I was going to write an article, not a book. When I started going to China, which was quite a different experience from what I was planning to do, the culture was just so different. I was just immersed in the culture because I had very good introductions. I do not, by the way, speak Chinese. I had studied Spanish for 10 years. I was a bilingual Spanish-English teacher. So friends and family wanted to know what on earth I was doing because I kept going back. And so I started something called China Images, which I was going to do once a month, just writing about things that I thought would be interesting to people. It turned out to be I did that about once a year, but I was always journaling. The idea of doing something was percolating the whole time. And of course, I was also writing academic articles because I was doing research. I ended up meeting An Wai. I worked with him of doing some projects for a couple of years run by an American organization. The first time I did that, I thought, oh, this is a great story, but it was impossible to even think about doing it because it was harvest time. Everyone was very busy. An Wai was very busy. And so I went back at a different time a couple of years later for 3 weeks, and it was a different season. So the village was more relaxed. And actually, there were some other volunteers there too. One of them convinced An Wai to tell everyone about the story of just growing up in the village, which he did. And in the middle of his talking, this other volunteer stopped him and said, someone has got to do a PhD on this story. And that gave me my chance. And so I said, I'm not going to do another PhD, but I would be glad to write an article. I went back several months later. He talked nonstop for 3 days, and he wove together his story with the history of China. And at the end of those 3 days, I knew it was more than an article. I was not interested in committing to a book, but somewhere in the back of my head, I knew it was going to be a book. I grabbed time when I could. I had a full-time job and I was doing research in China. So this was just an add-on to what I was doing in China, except I was fascinated by it. So I poked at it, I think is the word. I would write paragraphs. I kept trying to find voice. I started taking, and I realized that I had taken a couple of just two-day courses at UCLA in 2005 and 2006. I interviewed him those 3 days in 2006. So there was an overlap, obviously, between some vague interest I had in writing something and meeting him and interviewing him. And so those obviously coalesced at some point. I took some essay writing courses. Then in 2007, I really dug into taking more courses than I can believe I took. But my style, when I got the transcripts back, because I had everything transcribed, and this was all in English, by the way, it was not in Chinese, because he was very fluent in English. I would listen to the recording with the transcripts in front of me, making comments. There was this vast amount of information that I needed to process in some way. I would go into the transcripts, and besides just marking occasionally, he was laughing, he sounded angry or something like that, I separated. So when there was information about family, I just wrote family in it. So I sort of separated them in some ways because interviews go all over the place. Each time I interviewed him, and I interviewed him at least once a year for 10 years, and I just kept digging. And then I would collect questions. And he was very good at responding to emails. And so I would send him the easier questions that you could do by email. And then I would collect other questions for the next interview. So there was a routine that got started. And I had to keep digging in to figure out if I asked him the same question in 2 years, would he give me the same approximate answer? Or would it be completely different? So I was trying to sort of fact check in my own way. And meanwhile, I was trying to write off and on. I've always read nonfiction. I mean, even in high school, I read nonfiction. I was not one of these people who sat down and started writing books when I was 10 years old at all. But I had written newsletters and I learned from that. I did a community newsletter at one point about integration, which was not exactly a popular topic. So I was very careful and I revised articles until they were dead and learned that if you revise too much, you've had it as far as having an interesting thing. But I have no journalism background. I was an English major in college, but I didn't do anything creative or, you know, anything beyond the normal. I learned academic writing by going to graduate school and just finding anything, any little morsel of information I could find to succeed. The first book I wrote, because I wrote a book 10 years before this one, it was an academic book, and it did have stories in it, but when I started One in a Billion, I knew it had to be a narrative, and I spent a lot of time. That's why I took so many courses. I actually took a novel writing course at one point through UCLA, and the instructor said, "What on earth are you doing here?" And I just said, I needed some way to figure out how to bring Anhui to life, make it interesting. So I knew I had to learn narrative. I really started from scratch in a way. How long it took was forever, 15 years to write it. And of course, part of that was rewriting and writing. And I did stop for 3 years to write the other book because I knew the information I had, I'd lose it because it would be dated. It was just an ongoing project. I did it chapter by chapter, sort of. It took me a long time before I had any idea how to structure the book. Being chronological, I actually figured that was going to be boring, that maybe I should pick out themes and focus on them. I struggled with that a lot. The voice I worked on enormously, and these are the things that I began to try to work out during the courses. And of course, the instructors had an agenda too. And I took a lot of nonfiction writing, but just trying to figure it out. I even tried to write it once from Anhui's point of view, from the Chinese man's point of view. I sent it to him and all he did was laugh. It was obviously didn't work. And I finally, with advice, I think from one of the instructors, started writing in what I think is called the close third. I was sort of sitting on his shoulder. But there were other pieces, like I needed to get my own voice into it. That took basically, literally years. So this was not a writer sitting down and just going from one end to the other, that's for sure. I was fascinated partially by An Wei because he was such a unique, I'm sure there are other people like him in China, that's for sure. But at the same time, he was always pushing the envelope. He was always pushing back at things. One of his favorite adult saying, according to one of his friends, was, "How can we do it legally and get away with it?" Because he actually, while I knew him, he started a Democratic Congress in his village that lasted for 7 years. He knew all the laws that would allow that to happen, etc. He went through the Cultural Revolution. So he was bringing to light for me a lot of the Chinese history. I was fascinated to learn more about the rural country, and maybe because I grew up in a rural log cabin in New Jersey, you can believe it. And also just about the way of life and how people survived. Unbelievable ups and downs. Trusting my instincts of writing the book, I think evolved slowly, and partially I had friends who were reading things. They loved China images. They wanted me to do more of that. They were annoyed when I stopped writing and sharing with them One in a Billion when I stopped to do the other book. They were just infinitely frustrated that I wasn't continuing. And so that was probably pushing me. I think people critiquing it, it's really hard to grab hold of this piece. And my beginning to get the feeling that it really was a story that was had a beginning and the end. I spent 2 weeks on a grant at a writing workshop in Vermont. It's called the Vermont Studio Workshop. Great location if you like cold weather. 90% visual artists and 10% writers, which for me was perfect because the visual artists think in a really different way from a writer. I was just engaged and helped to think outside the box. So I had gone for a couple of weeks for the first book. I went again when I was probably way into writing One in a Billion, but not knowing where I was going. And I spent 2 weeks just digging. And this is probably when it really fell into place, because by the end of those 2 weeks, I had the arc of the story. And it was obvious that his life provided that arc. And I did that by talking in depth with people and with also the visual artists. So I think that's probably when it really gelled. That recognition and understanding even what an arc was provided me with impetus that just kept me going. Because then I had sort of, I had a picture. And in fact, I had drawn it out. I mean, with the various things, and it was above my desk at home, along with a lot of other things that are always above my desk, but it was probably a foot and a half long with pieces of paper taped together. Basically, a storyboard, I guess, in my own invention of that, and just with his life story. So I didn't follow it exactly, but then I could really dig back into all of those transcripts, which was enormously time consuming, and pull things out, starting with his family, starting with the village. And that actually enhanced my conversations with him because I ended up with details. He loved to talk about big pictures, about the history, about the politics, about people he really didn't like, whom he worked with. I wanted to know what they ate and what they wore, and he couldn't have cared less. And so it took me some time to dig into that. I finally realized if I photograph pictures from old National Geographics, maybe I could find some things that were similar. And that eventually worked. He got very enthusiastic when he saw a plow that was like the one he had used, etc. It probably helped me interview him because it became more of a dialogue. I was able to dig into getting him to talk more freely. And at some point, I had an agent because I had an agent from a, I mean, I had to learn all that stuff, which I knew nothing about, zero, period, to get an agent. First, I had for a long time subscribed to some writing magazines, so I knew that there were things called agents. I didn't know what they did. I certainly didn't know about book proposals, which I had to learn about. I probed bookstores, anything I could find anywhere online. I finally figured out there was a book about writing proposals. And so I learned that you have to do that to sell a book. And it's arduous. It's all the stuff you don't want to do. But having an ongoing, interesting book made it possible to do that because I wanted it out there. I didn't just want to put it under a pillow when I was through. I had written one for the other book too, so I knew by then what to do. Because it's a nonfiction book, it doesn't require that you have the whole book written, unlike a novel. I had a couple of really well written chapters, which I had sent out to lots of critiquers, et cetera, to make sure it was okay. I created the marketing plan. I did all the stuff that you have to do, which is nauseating, I think, for many writers, and sent it to her. She was fine with it. I think I wrote that proposal about 3 or 4 chapters in, and long before I went to Vermont to the studio center, because I needed to get her trying to sell it. And it was a hard sell. It was a hard sell because my agent said the publishers kept saying, it's very interesting. It's an interesting person. It's well written. Nobody knows who he is and it won't sell. I mean, that went on for several years. Then I wrote another one because after several years of it not selling, I began to realize that memoirs were very popular and they are written about people no one knows about. So what was the problem with writing a book about someone no one knew about? I talked to my agent and I said, what if I call it a biographical memoir and write it as if it's Anhui's memoir from a third person point of view? And she liked that idea. She said, of course, the only problem is you have to finish the book. And so I went back to writing a lot. I think at some point I'm just plain stubborn and I keep after things. You know, I'm sure my children would be glad to tell you that. And I just kept going. I mean, I'd done a dissertation for my PhD. That certainly gives you a little preliminary work on that. And I had started taking UCLA courses, several, the intermediate creative nonfiction, the art of creative writing, narrative techniques for nonfiction. I sort of took everything that was online that I could. Then I wrote to one of the instructors and said, can I take this course again? And so for a while, every chapter was a course. But that's a very slow process. And as I got farther and farther and farther into the book, you know, the critiquers, the other students would say, but you didn't tell us anything about X. Well, that's 3 chapters back. I finally had to hire someone to basically step in. And he was very good. You know, I'd send him 10 pages and he'd say, get rid of the first 5. So that went on for some time. And I also had an editor who had also been the editor of my other book. I think when I was revising, I had a couple of things going for me. I had a couple of friends who were very good at critiquing. So I had been getting critiques from the course students, but that was limited compared to what my 2 friends were doing. One was a Baptist minister who was also a copy editor. He had one style and the other one had another style. So he was very detailed. If he didn't understand something, he'd look it up on the internet. We had a lot of arguments about commas, but he was very helpful in getting me to be more precise and precise in wording. The other person was very interested in the process of writing a book. She never knew what it took. And so she was interested in the bigger picture. And she was very good at just raising questions about things I hadn't even thought about including on way, about what was going on in his life or in the history. So those 2 people who were really so different in their critiques were very helpful in my own revising. And of course, the thing that I really wanted it to do was I wanted it to read like a good novel. And every critique I got was helpful. I always am annoyed when people say, even my friends who are critiquing, I want to fight back and say, no, 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 it's already there, or you don't need it or something. And then, of course, 3 days later, I think, oh, I guess they're right. So that's just so I did it. And then you have to throw out some ideas that don't work. the person I had hired kept trying to get me to put my voice into the narrative, and I couldn't make it work. And in fact, I pulled it out and it worked much better. My story is italicized in the book. I think I finally was able to end it, which is of course hard for any book. I mean, to end it without being melodramatic, to just sort of bring it to a close and leave it there. It was a good feeling and terrifying when I sent what I thought was the final edition to my agent. And it didn't sell for a long time. I mean, this was not as long as the first process, but in fact, there was a point at which I wrote her and said, how about self-publishing? Because I was beginning to feel it really needed to get out there because life was going on. She said, you're probably right, but give me a couple of months more. And so we talked in September, and she said, give me till Thanksgiving. And in about late October, she sold it. The acquisitions editor from Roman and Littlefield wrote, I mean, I couldn't believe it. She said, it's beautifully written. It's a wonderful story. I probably cried. It was hard to believe that that was also true. And of course, I didn't ever have to do much revision for them, but there's a lot of editing and detail work that is just detailed work, period. It was a little complicated because after I signed a contract, and I had done one book before, that was my real learning process. I have over the years written a lot of documents for the state of California because I'm an educator. So I was used to dotting the I's and crossing the T's and doing everything they wanted me to do. So they never came back and asked me to do it again. And so that actually paid off as far as working with a copy editor because I'm pretty careful. And that just takes patience. I had to pace myself. I did a lot of reading the book aloud before I actually sent it, two or three times. And that I had to do carefully because I did more than about 10 pages at a time. I had no idea what I was reading or saying. I zoned out. So that kind of thing was a lot of it's tedious, but at the same time, it was such a pleasure to be doing it. And they were pushing me. The contract said they would publish it within the calendar year. And I signed the contract in the beginning of January 2020, and COVID hit in March. And they were furloughed for 6 weeks. And I just thought, well, it's been a long time. It's going to be a lot longer. They actually managed to publish it at the end of November of the year. But that meant I had to keep producing for them because I knew enough about just dealing with photographs and things that I needed to actually get permissions. So I had all the permissions from Anhui and from China that I needed as I went. And I had friends collecting some of that. So there are a lot of details like that I had to find out, like what in heaven's name you have someone sign to give you permission for things. Because, I mean, they're photographs of Anhui with Jimmy Carter and people like that. So I had to be very careful. The one that they really wanted to use, I had at 31 kilobytes, which is tiny, which Anhui had sent me. It was from years ago. I said, is there any way you can up this a little bit? So he got it up about 20 kilobytes, but it was still tiny. My copy editor said, you know, the photographic people are amazing, and let's see what they can do with it. And they did it. And it came through, they sent me two covers and they asked me which one I preferred. And I selected one to me was just obviously better than the other. Both my acquisition editor and her assistant wrote back and said, oh, thank you. Because that was the one they had picked too. It was just very tasteful and a good design. One of the things that I had to learn, and it took me a long time to do this, was to try to believe in myself. And part of that, because writing is so, and of course you read this all the time about writers who are just, you know, they can't believe what they're doing is any good, they're self-critical, and it's very easy to be enormously self-critical and you write something and think, oh, this is terrible. No one's going to read it. It's just something that, you know, I'm wasting my time. I found that having friends who were reading bits and pieces of it and were my cheerleaders, and also I was very fortunate that my husband was a real cheerleader. He was just enthusiastic. He was learning along with me as far as what was going on in China. But I think my friends spread far apart were very helpful in just keeping me going. Believing in yourself is hard. And so you have to find some kind of support system that will help with that.
And now a reading from One in a Billion.
China 2004. I clutched the seat in front of me as our minibus turned off the macadam and lurched across deep ruts toward Anshan Village, the obscure village in central China where my host, An Wei, grew up and where his siblings still lived. The wheels hit a deep rut and toppled a funeral arrangement An Wei was taking to a village family. The two young Chinese women with us jumped up and caught it before it hit the floor. With the intact flower arrangement clasped safely on their laps, they convulsed in laughter, while in the front seat, An Wei, oblivious to what was happening behind him, continued nonstop conversations on his two cell phones. I was one of three American volunteers beginning a several-week assignment in the village to help rural high school teachers of English strengthen their language skills. I had been studying education in China for 2 decades, organizing programs between my university in California and those in China, and enjoying hours in the homes of Chinese friends in Nanjing and Beijing. It was nearly impossible for foreigners to spend substantive time in the countryside, however, so these weeks were golden. We were hosted by an American organization that An Wei had introduced to China in an effort to create a bridge between our two countries. While we taught, the villagers brought in a harvest of breathtakingly deep yellow corn and then planted winter wheat. An Wei, who made our schedules, believed the day off should be filled with additional work. So 7 days a week, we planned lessons late into the night, learned about rural living from the teachers, and helped them with their conversational English. As I left Anshan Village that autumn, I knew I would return. I longed to feel the rhythm of the seasons that permeated every part of rural life. Subsequent trips took me deeper into peasant life, and on each trip, I watched An Wei move from one village project to the next, negotiating, cajoling, and organizing. Now, having become an educated professional in the city of Xi'an, he was building a bridge not only between villagers and American volunteers, but also between rural existence and modern China. I continued to do research on Chinese education methods, returning a couple of times a year. In addition, I began to spend several days during my visits with An Wei and his wife, learning as much as I could from him about the complex beginnings of the People's Republic of China and how they affected the lives of individuals. When he began primary school in 1950, the new nation was a year old. An Wei belongs to the generation born in the old society that grew up under the communism of Mao Zedong. For decades, he has been buffeted by the dramatic changes in China. In a recent email to me, he wrote, "As the Chinese saying goes, a small sign can indicate a great trend. Just like a tiny leaf on a huge tree, I went through all the seasons and endured all the storms along with my tree." Beyond the sweep of headlines and massive social, political, and economic changes, beyond the Confucian Analects and the Tao Te Ching, millions of Chinese people carry their own stories of their life's travails and dreams. An Wei is one of them. In some ways, like everyone else, yet he stands out from the crowd. His story is one of survival in ever-shifting and sometimes dangerous times. It is a compelling story of a resourceful individual determined to work toward a goal despite myriad compromises that he accepted to survive. Resilient to the core, he continued to fight injustice when others gave up. He saw defeat as a chance to battle again. In the process, he has become a guiding light for young Chinese who want to improve their homeland.
The Right Process is hosted and curated by me, Charlie Jensen. This season was produced by Jamie Moss. The Writers Program offers courses, certificates, and services that help writers achieve their writing goals one page at a time. For more information, visit writers.uclaextension.edu.